Medical Donation Hotline at 877-308-2408. You're tuned in to commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston, radio for peace.
Listeners should be aware that the following program contains language and audio images which may be found disturbing and may not be suitable for your snotty-nosed little brat who probably cusses like a sailor behind your back anyway. Parental discretion is advised.
Welcome to another edition of Technology Bites on KPFT.
All right, welcome to the show, and I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Dwight.
And he's...
Roofhouse.
Peter's on vacation, as is Flicted, although Peter's vacation is probably not as glamorous as Flicted's. Peter's gone to Minnesota, right? Yeah, Minnesota.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Minnesota.
Minnesota. And Flicted, well... He's in the red. He's in the red zone. He's in Russia. All right. Wow. When is he coming back anyway? Does anybody know?
Yet.
No, I never. Do not know. All right. Well, we miss him. All right. Well, welcome to the show. We're glad you could tune in. That means no info shot. So we will be going to calls sooner than later. So you might want to dial in and get in the queue for that. 713-526-5738. But first... You can visit us online at www.geekradio.com. That is the website for the show, geekradio.com, with all the relevant information you need for experiencing and participating in Technology Bites this evening. We hang out, IRC, irc.cuckoo.com. The channel is Tech Bites. It's the show within a show. There's about 10 people in there now, 9 people in there right now, including myself. So you can come on in and join the show within a show, hang out with other geeks. You can call us. We gave you that. You can use the contact form on the webpage to send questions if you would like to. If you don't want to call in but you still want some help with an issue, you are welcome to use that contact form, and we'll try to get back with you during the week and answer your questions. All right. So... got all the Macs going. We got an Air. We got a Pro. We got a new Pro.
Retina display.
Dwight has one of the new MacBook Pros, the 15-inch, right?
15.4, I think.
15.4-inch MacBook Pro.
It has the Retina display.
What is a Retina display?
It has so many damn pixels that you can't see the damn pixels.
Like 5.6 million plus.
Right.
On one screen.
Has a pixel density of 220 pixels per inch, which is pretty good. and it's pretty impressive. What's really impressive is the speed of it. It's got a very fast flash memory and a very good processor. And so when you click almost any app, you know, on the Mac, when you click an app on the dock, it bounces. And almost all the apps, it bounces up and it launches before the bounce can come back down to the dock. That's pretty amazing.
Now, we've only seen that with, you know, the standard load applications. We're really curious to see it load up a VMware or Parallels or, you know, virtual machine or some heavy hitter like...
Right. Well, the virtual machine will take as long as it takes to, you know, when you shut down a virtual machine, like say you're running Windows on it, when you shut it down, you can suspend it and it essentially writes the state of the memory to the hard drive and then pulls it back up. And so what happens is you have a situation where you're just waiting for the hard drive to pull it up. Well, if it's on a flash drive, it comes up really fast. On the Air, it launches almost immediately. Last time I used an Air. With this, I can't wait to see what happens when you do.
Speaking of Air, that's not much thicker than an Air. I mean, it's probably half the size of the last, you think, or maybe not quite that much.
It's a little bit thicker than, I mean, an Air goes down almost to, like, you can almost
just about nothing
chop
on the
carrots
front.
On the
but
edge.
They've reduced the size. I mean, I've got and it's half the size of the...
They took the taper out of the Air. That's what they did.
Yeah, they put batteries all along the front. That's the other thing. It's not really serviceable. I mean, the batteries are glued in there, the RAM soldered on.
Right.
So if you buy one, you need to buy it with what you think you're going to need two or 3 years from now.
Now, when the battery does eventually die, is it just not replaceable?
No, you can take it to Apple and say, please, sir, may I have another?
So they basically charge you.
Right. Whatever. And although, for example, if you take in the unibody MacBook Pro, like the 13-inch, I think the 15-inch too, it's $129 to replace the battery. If you buy a battery for most full-size computers, you know, the brand name one is about...
They're about 80 to 100 anyway.
Right. So you're essentially paying $30 to have somebody put the battery in for you, which is, you know, depending on how you feel about that, is reasonable.
Although, I mean, if you're dropping $2,000 to $3,000 on a laptop, you know, you probably shouldn't quibble over $20 on a battery.
Yes,
you know?
Exactly. So the battery life on this, I haven't had it long enough to really test, but I'm running a clear stick on it. I don't have the brightness ratcheted down at all. You know, I'm just doing, I'm kind of just using it. It was fully charged, and right now it's at about... it says 13 hours and 47 minutes remaining. I doubt that, but we'll see. Probably isn't calibrated yet. So I like it, and the screen is impressive. The one interesting thing about it is that apps that aren't optimized for this or aren't using OS X's Cocoa libraries look really fuzzy. So like the Twitter for Mac app from Twitter looks awful. But EchoPhone, which uses the Cocoa libraries, the text looks really good. Chrome looks okay, but Safari looks wonderful in it. So, you know, there's going to be a lot of developers have to do some work to get it to look great on here. It also means that website developers have to increase the resolution on their websites. Like on cron.com looks pretty good on a regular computer, the logo and the graphics that we have on it. But on this, it gets a little fuzzy.
On the plus side, photographers who've had their low res images stolen for websites, they won't look so good anymore.
I don't want to steal that.
Can you put up a high res version that I can steal?
A really high res? Yeah, so it's, you know, is it worth $2,200?
That's entry. That's the cheapest one you can get.
Right.
You
know?
That's the cheapest?
Yeah,
that's
the cheapest,
Pro?
Right. But cheap for Retina.
For Retina, right.
They have updated the standard line. You can still buy the standard 15.4 and 13-inch. They have updated those in terms of processors and memory and so forth. They've updated the MacBook Air, but none of them have Retina except this new one. So if you're interested in it, to me, unless you got to have it now, if you're a professional photographer, this is a great choice. If you know you need high-end graphics, but if you just want Retina and you think it's cool and you have a notebook computer you're happy with now, I wouldn't rush out and replace it with this. I'd wait to see, because eventually Apple will move this into all of its notebooks, and when that happens, probably it'll be more reasonably priced.
Underway, yeah, a 13-inch Retina display with a 500 gig SSD or flash memory or whatever they want to call it would be nice. I like my 13-inch MacBook Pro. It's just about right for travel and processing images on the run. But having an enhanced display would be nice, and a faster processor and faster performance. All right. Well, we're going to give out the phone number again, 713-526-5738. We are taking calls on the air this evening. Peter Hughes is off on vacation, so there is no info shot. The only news we have is about Dwight's MacBook. Now, I will say, while we're waiting for someone to call, 713-526-5738, your Twitter stream for the updates on what they were announcing was very readable, and as opposed to some of the other live bloggings were just they were difficult to follow, and kind of they were referencing previous updates, so you had to kind of like read everything to understand what these updates were. But yours were nice encapsulations about what they were talking about. Here's this. So I wanted to congratulate you on that. I thought
it still didn't stop me from unfollowing you again.
Whoa.
I just followed you for like, I picked you back up like for a week, and then there you go.
Well, I warned.
I know you warned. You did warn.
Right.
And I failed to comment, but.
And there's a feature. I don't know what Twitter client you use, but.
I've just learned about the mute feature.
Yeah.
I like it a lot. So I think next time I'll just mute you.
Right. And some clients, I don't know which ones, but some clients have a timed mute. So, like, if you know that something is going to be over in 2 hours, then you can just set it to refollow.
Wow. Or 6 months or a year. That's pretty good. I like that a lot.
So you're following me now, Groovehouse, right?
Yes. Okay. Yes, I am.
All right.
Do you even read that you're now being... Do you even get notified when you get new followers?
Yes.
Okay. So do you even read those anymore?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I'm on Twitter.
So you don't, like, think twice when you see Groovehouse is following you again? When did he unfollow you? So you don't get the alert when they stop.
Honestly, I hadn't followed Dwight in quite a while.
I can get verbose, although because my job has changed. This is ironic. My job has changed at the Chronicle. I'm more social media oriented, but I use Twitter less because I'm manning our Facebook page. I run our Facebook page.
Wow!
And so I'm paying more attention to Facebook than Twitter at the moment. And when I do get back on Twitter, it's like, oh, hello, old friend.
All right, 713-526-5738. I know you're not used to being asked to call into the show this early, because usually we're blathering on, and we have the nice info shot and stuff. But with Pete out of town, we are opening the phones up a little early. We've got, you know, an hour and 45 minutes of show to fill with your calls. So if you want to give us a ring, if you have a question or concern, or just want to talk tech, 713-526-5738. We're not asking for money, which is always a plus. Always a good thing. Well, I did, while we're waiting on calls that are not coming, I got my plane tickets for DEF CON, so I'm happy about that. Hotel's booked. DEF CON is the only variable left out there is whether or not Barrett's going to make it out there in time and wake up in time to get in line to get our badges.
Definitely. I did last time, too, yeah.
You did last time. I was very proud of you.
Two hours of sleep, I was there.
So the weird flight times, too. I'm coming in, like, in the evening.
What day? Thursday?
Thursday. Yeah, Thursday. I'll be in Thursday afternoon. So, 713-526-5738 if you want to be on the air with Technology Bites. We have all of our lines open. That's weird. There's nobody calling. What if we had a call-in show and nobody called?
Oh, no.
So, in terms of the Apple... What happened this week, if you were living under a rock, was the Worldwide Developer Conference for Is that just an Apple-only event?
Yes. And Apple runs it.
Apple runs it. It's
all of the they gather their developers together, and usually that's where they show updates to their mobile and desktop operating systems and OS X, which had already really been kind of the next version. Mountain Lion had been showed off earlier in the year, and then they took the wraps off iOS 6, which will be coming out sometime in the fall. What's really interesting about OS X is that it'll be released next month, and in the past, OS X updates had been $29. This is going to be $19.
Wow.
Which is a great deal.
Yeah.
So I'm quite excited about it. The problem with iOS 6 is that while there's some cool features in it, iPhone 4 users are not going to get to use some of the coolest features, like turn-by-turn navigation and 3D maps will not work on iPhone 4. But the iOS 6 won't work at all on the original iPad.
Mm-hmm.
Which is very sad.
So they're kicking Google Maps out. They're
saying bye-bye to Google Maps. They're doing their own kind of hybrid mapping solution. They're getting their maps from TomTom. They're getting crowdsourced traffic data from a variety of sources, including Waze, which is an app that is pretty good on the iPhone. And Google is bye-bye. And so essentially they're going to be doing this all themselves.
Are they moving towards more of a services kind of oriented thing? Was this kind of a sign that they're going to go kind of go services to make some more money off that, not just, you know, hardware sales?
Well, the thing is, with Apple often seems to be giving away its services. So iCloud is free.
Mm-hmm.
This will be, you know, the apps connection is free. I mean, the map connection is free. So they're not necessarily charging for their services. I think they see services as a way to tie different hardware components together. So it's essentially a way to sell the hardware and make sure everybody stays in the Apple ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. And all the while, isn't Google possibly going to come out with a Google phone? I mean, an actual, aren't they doing something? I'm sorry. Yeah.
Well, their own. Well,
their
yes,
own.
Yes.
I mean, even, no, not so much like, you know, saying like this is the official phone, but actually aren't they in cahoots with like HTC to release their own? Like there's
an
Apple iPhone.
Well, they have talked to, they have said that they're looking at doing Nexus phones for multiple vendors. So they would do a Nexus HTC. They'd do a Nexus Motorola, which they now own. They would do a Nexus Samsung and, you know, whoever else. And so you essentially would have that brand everywhere, but that would say, this is how we think a Android smartphone should be.
Mm-hmm.
And that will be... Now, what the article is, they own tablet.
Tablet, yeah. I think that's where I got crossed. I think it's the tablets, but I'd heard rumors of.
Right.
So I'm excited about that, too.
Yes. So they're going to have an iOS 6... Siri comes to the iPad 3.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And Siri apparently is very much improved.
It will do more.
It actually works now?
I don't know if it works, but it will now do sports scores, and it'll do...
what every nerd wants.
Right. And it will do... it'll do restaurants, and it will do
I like
with
the thing
Yelp.
It'll do the open table reservations.
Right. Oh,
it'll do...
nice.
It
opens apps now, so you can tell it to launch an app.
It'll like, if you make a movie reservation, it'll bring up your pass when you get to the theater.
Yes, that's Passbook. That's another app. The other thing it'll do is it will now do movie showtimes, which the original Siri app would do. But when it went to the iPhone 4 S, suddenly it wouldn't do it. When it was iPhone 4 S, it wouldn't do it. When you could get the as just an app, it would do Showtime. So they're kind of bringing some features back. Whether it's more accurate and whether the servers can handle the load remains to be seen.
713-526-5738 is the number to call. If you want to be on the air with us during this episode of Technology Bites, we invite you to call 713-526-KPFT. What were you going to say, Bert?
The talk of Apple will continue until a call comes in. Aren't they also trying to get Siri into cars? Like, isn't it Apple for eyes?
Well, they're working on...
They're working on making Siri where the iPhone could be asleep, even... and you could trigger a button on the car. So they're talking about making systems on the new Hondas and a number of other different brand cars are going to support this. So that's really going to be interesting. Basically, you're going to be able to hands-free tweet because it will interface with that.
Or look up traffic or, you know, get weather conditions or, you know.
Or have your iPad talk sexy to you. Whatever you need, we're just getting down the road. 713-526-5738. It's awfully quiet out there. I don't know what's going on.
Are the phones working? Shall we call a phone?
Call a phone. Well, no, I saw it ring. Didn't somebody try to dial in?
It rang, and then it hung up.
We're going to test it.
I'm sure they work.
I'm sure they work, too.
People are just getting into the show.
What's the phone number, Jay?
713-526-5738.
Okay.
713-526-KPFT. I see one ringing. That could be. That's not Dwight. Oh, that's Dwight on the second.
Oh, no, but there's someone else now.
Right.
All right. Perfect. 713-526-5738. Yeah, I was kind of disappointed. I don't know which one I want to update first, but I was thinking it was going to be the iMac first. And they didn't announce any new iMac products.
No.
Although that's due for an upgrade. It's way, way late in the cycle. So right. I was kind of surprised they didn't say anything.
Well, they
upgraded their prices. Jeez.
They did upgrade the, actually the MacBook Air prices came down $100, the base. They did upgrade the Mac Pro, but just minorly. And there were a lot of complaints about it. And some Apple executives at WWDC and talking to the press said, like Dave, they told David Pogue, we'll have an update to the Mac Pro in 2013. And he had been told that iMacs also would be updated. And Apple corrected and said, no, it will not happen in 2013. The implication possibly being that it would happen before that. Apple wasn't saying. And Tim Cook sent somebody an email saying, who complained to him directly, saying, yeah, we'll have Mac Pro updates in 2013. Didn't say anything about the iMac. So my suspicion is that the new iMac will be coming before that. I would say probably in the fall. I wouldn't be surprised if it's not in the fall.
All right, 713-526-5738. It does look like we've got some calls in the queue.
Yay.
And, wow, it's really lighting up now.
Groovehouse is going to be
busy. Let's
go
ahead and just grab the first one, and then Groovehouse will get
that. That's going to be Nick.
Nick, you're on the air with Technology Bites. Nick, hey, Groovehouse, turn up the phone. Sorry. There you go. Hey, Nick.
Okay. Yeah.
All right.
Okay, great deal. Listen, I work at a large high school here in town, and the pressure is on to buy a form factor that is really affordable, say sub $500, and has the ability to work with office documents for editing and then research and wireless, but it has to have a long battery power. So the push is on to put iPads there, but it's a whole different administration. My question is, do you think that these new kind of ARM-based laptops or ultrabooks are going to be the kind of institution-sized form factor for employees or students, the one-to-one solution, or is it going to be Apple with these iPads kind of subverting the standard laptop and Microsoft-based institution?
Well, by ARM-based notebooks, if you're talking about the Windows 8 notebooks that are coming this fall, that's what Microsoft hopes, that is it. The one problem with that, with those applications is that they'll run a version of Windows 8 called Windows RT, which I like to think stands for Windows Retweet. And one of the problems with Windows RT is that you cannot install any legacy x86 applications, traditional Windows desktop applications on it. All you can install on them are the new Metro UI applications. And so what that means is...
no Microsoft Office.
Well, I think Office is an exception. And actually, it will come with Office, but on the Metro. So kind of like with the Metro version of Office already installed on it. So, but, you know, if you want to do anything else, it's got to be a Metro app. So if your school has Windows software that it likes and it wants to run... you better hope that there's a Metro version for it.
So it's still a whole kind of retooling of your standard software packages and basically going from a mouse and keyboard world to a touch option world means that the apps have to be written again for the interface, but also for the chip. So are they going to catch up, or are the app developers on the iPad going to have such a lead time of sophistication that it makes Microsoft keep looking clumsy? So it's a weight game, I guess.
Microsoft is behind the you know, at least if you're not using the Windows RT platform, if you're using, say, an Ultrabook, which is not the same thing, that it uses an Intel chip, you can still run the other, you still run traditional Windows desktop software.
Yeah, I guess that's it. They can develop a device that lasts 10 hours for real, then, or, you know, 8 for real hours, that could last a whole school day of usage.
Right. And if you're using, if using an iPad, it's been around long enough, and the software is developed enough that probably there, you know, what you need is available. Certainly there's a whole textbook ecology that's built up around iPad. And so, you know, it's certainly simpler. They're easier to maintain. And in general, they're cheaper. And so, you know, administrators may look at that and go, yep, that's a much better and a much simpler solution for us.
Yeah, because those notebooks we have now are like in the $950 range for a 3-year warranty notebook, whereas an iPad comes in at $500 and does 85% of what the laptop is typically used for.
Right.
So it's, okay, well, hopefully they can get the battery time long enough, and then we can just keep our standard Microsoft server world.
What, I mean, when you talk about the battery life on a laptop, I mean, what are they doing now for that? They're setting up labs with desktop computers to use to do the computer-based stuff, and that's probably even less expensive.
Right. There's 700-something. So it's a $200 difference for starter pipes. And, you know, there's, it's still that kind of form factor. What's going to, it's easy to move around, what's easy to replace, what's cheap enough to buy in large enough numbers, and you don't care if it gets broken or stolen because it's too difficult to repair anyway, so you just keep running with, you buy a new one because you can afford two for the same price as the one you have that is an Internet Explorer workstation pretty much most of the time. So that's a, that's still, we're waiting for all the lines, kind of where does it intersect to know what to buy into big to have enough computers for every student to expect them to.
Well, another option might be to consider in, you know, the school, you know, I know that places like public schools and other, you know, nonprofit organizations struggle with their technology because they don't have the money to pay people who are really innovative and know what they're doing and understand all the technology. But it seems to me that there'd be a lot of room in the school system to do virtualization. And you could set up systems to where you could have a Windows desktop that was accessible from an iPad using something like Citrix or Terminal Server to run it.
Right. I think that would be optimum. And I've talked to administrators in the district who said they would really like that too because it plays to their strengths and the redundancy and resiliency. But the budget's, you know, decentralized. So every school has its own money and the IT department doesn't have enough to pay for it itself. So unless somebody has a cake sale or they combine budgets, they won't be able to make that kind of server farm virtualization that you would hope for.
Yeah, it's tough.
In-house, secure, so on and so forth.
Right.
So we'll see. Maybe these new Ultrabooks that come out will do the job, or I don't know what they're going to do to improve upon the iPad more than it is already for the price and capability, but that's my kind of big question of what do I buy into big next, you know? Like
right.
More, you know. It'll be another 2 years before it shakes out. So we'll see what happens.
Well, you could also consider buying a laptop with an extra battery.
Yeah, we do that, but they're big and heavy.
Yeah.
HPs, they have this giant egg underneath it that you have to, that'll fall off sometimes. And, you know, it's just, you can do that, but it's better just to plug in power, buy a $30 power supply and zip tie it to a desk and keep it powered all day.
Well, yeah, I know they're working on wireless charging, too, so that would be something else.
Yeah, microwave everybody in the room. All right, thanks, guys. Right, we'll talk to you later.
Thanks for your call. All right, yeah. All right, Groove House,
yes.
How's it going in there?
It's going great.
Yeah?
Yeah.
All of a sudden, all the phone lines lit up
once. And y'all started the show without me.
Well, we couldn't wait.
I was, okay.
Well, I mean, we, you know.
Yeah, I know. It's your show.
Lord, I was just trying to take the pressure off you because you're screening all these calls. I figured you could give up one call, but you could have all the rest.
Well, let him revel in his pain for a little bit.
Oh, I'm sorry. Here.
Here's he owns his pain.
Now, let me send you a picture of a decapitated flower. Oh. You should have found the stem. Taking the picture of that. All right, Groove House.
Yes, Jay.
If it's not too much trouble.
Yes, sir.
I wouldn't want to bother you.
Yes, what would you like?
I would like to know who's up next.
Up next on the show?
Yeah, who wants to be on the air with us?
All right, up next on the show, by length of hold, we're going to take Bill.
Bill, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
You know, when y'all were talking about there wasn't any calls in the queue and the phone lit up, that was me, and y'all called Nick first. That ain't right.
Groove House's fault. He wasn't here to guide us.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, if he hadn't have been drowning in his own whatever, he would have been.
Oh, that's right, because Dwight called on line one and tied up line one, line, yeah, the line two. So
oh,
we're sorry,
that's
Bill.
What happened.
Yeah.
Oh, well, we're
it's Dwight's
sorry.
Fault.
We're sorry.
You guys are great, man. Thanks a lot.
All right, is that it?
No! I got subjects. No, I wanted to ask about backup software. I've been using Western Digital on a MyBook external, and it's acting up. Like, today I realized it hadn't backed up in like 2 weeks, and I'm trying to do two copies of my main drive. I've got Windows backup making one copy, and then I was using Western Digital for an external copy, but I'm looking for something new. And I talked to Acronis today, and they said after 30 days, they really don't provide any kind of customer service on the phone or email unless you pay for it. So that kind of put me off some. But I just wanted to get y'all's opinion on what y'all thought might be good backup software.
Backup software?
Yeah, I mean, Windows, unless y'all know, I was wondering if I could use Windows Backup to make two copies, like one to one drive and then another copy to another
well,
drive.
Well, I don't use backup software myself. I don't think Microsoft Backup's all that great. I don't like the way that it manages backups and the way that it creates them. But in terms of making two copies of something, you can buy external hard drives that are rated. Basically, there's two hard drives, and the computer sees it as one drive. So you have 2 1-terabyte drives in an enclosure. The computer sees it as a single 1-terabyte drive, but when you write to it, it writes the same data to both drives. So you have two copies of it. So you only have to do the one backup, but you get two copies every time you do it.
Uh-huh.
So whatever backup software you land on would access that drive. Now, I don't know if you're looking to spend more money on hardware or you just want to use what you have, but when I buy external hard drives, I buy RAID drives that have two drives in them. That's one option for you. In terms of backup software that would look at two different disks as backup locations, I don't know.
Never heard of that before, and I'm not sure why you would do that.
Well, he wants to have two copies.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're doing all your storage off your PC like I do, you want to have two copies of that, because typically if you keep it all on your hard drive and on an external drive, that's two copies. But if you move it completely off your physical hard drive, your main drive, off to another drive, you don't want to just put that on one drive. You want to put it on two so that you'll have two copies of it. And I was talking about I use RAID to accomplish that. But if you're using some other backup software, is there an option to tell it to do a backup to one drive? I guess you could probably, some backup software should have things where you can set up
multiple locations. In fact, the other option would be to send one off-site.
Yeah, that's what I've done. I took one to my parents' house. Like, I have 2 3-terabyte MyBook Western Digitals. And I've got one of my parents, and the Western Digital Smartware, or whatever you call it, backup software, is supposed to be able to, if you unplug it and you plug it back in at some point, it's supposed to be able to tell where it left off, but it failed at that too. It started doing a brand new backup when I tried to do that. So that's when I was wondering if there's a software or whatever that can do that as well, like unplug a drive, and then when you plug it back in, it can recognize it and pick up right where it left off, you know, so it can do off-site.
No, I don't know if there's one that will do that or not. Let's see. Multiple external hard drives. Oh, come on. I'm typing in
unfortunately, so nobody else is talking while I'm trying to do this.
I'm looking up other things. Has anyone used NovaStore? Backup in your store?
I used NovaStore years ago, but not
it's
recently.
It's still around. I'm looking at it. There's not a lot of, because I guess a lot of the operating systems have kind of taken it upon themselves to have backup built into right. it, you know, especially, you know, with Mac stuff. But, yeah, I used it a long time ago, but it looks like it's still out there. They're still updating it, so.
NovaStore?
Yeah, it's like NovaStore.com, and it looks like it's still free, too.
Oh, really?
So that might be something you might want to check out if the stuff that shipped with your Western Digital drive isn't doing you right.
Yeah, the other thing you could do is you could have two backup programs.
Yeah, you could do one
that would go to send it to one drive and one that would send it to another, and just make sure they don't run concurrently at the same time. You know, schedule them so they run at different times, and that would be a solution.
Yeah, maybe even use the built-in Windows backup for one of them, and you know, put it on the Windows scheduler and have it just kick off at a different time of night right. or on a different day. And that way, you know, if anything ever goes wrong with one backup, you've always got a different kind of backup to fall back to. So,
the other option is to just manually drag over your user folder. You know, even in is your computer running Windows 7 or Windows XP or what?
Windows 7.
Yeah, I mean, you get more data than you actually needed for the backup. But if you were to grab your user folder, that would get all your documents and your music. You could just drag and drop that onto whatever drive you wanted to every now and again.
Yeah.
And then just be prepared to reinstall your operating system. That's usually whenever my system crashes and I have to replace the hard drive or whatever, I take that as an opportunity to just do a clean install, because you end up with your computer as it goes along. You have all these applications installed, a lot of them you may not use anymore, and you're back and all that, and it's just junk. So you have an opportunity to reload your system. You load the operating system and you just load the applications you actually use, and then your documents and pictures and stuff.
Have you guys heard of RoboCopy that's built into Windows 7? It's short for Robust Copy. So it lets users make like highly advanced backups. Go Google for that if you want to. It's like R-O-B-O-C-O-P-Y. And some people have written some scripts out there that you can maybe just, you know, like save to a batch file, then you link to it from your scheduler. So it might be a little bit over your head, but it might not be. It's a way to learn a little bit of scripting. But it looks like it's Xcopy on steroids is what they're saying about it. So it's actually built into Windows.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, this is new to me. I haven't used it, so, you know, I don't know exactly what it's like, but there are a lot of people talking about it.
Okay. Do y'all know, does Time Machine have the ability to do that on Macs, to copy the two different drives?
You can have two different drives designated, but it won't send it to two different drives at two different times. You have to go in and say, okay, now send it to this drive.
Okay.
But it doesn't do it automatically.
Okay. Well, hey, thanks a lot, guys.
All right, Walker. Thanks for your call tonight.
Yep. Y'all have a good one.
All right. 713-526-5738 is the number to call if you want to be on the air with us tonight. We have plenty of calls in the queue, so we're not hurting for callers, but we do have some open lines if you want to participate. You can dial 713-526-KPFT. Grewhouse?
Yes.
Who's up?
Up next, we're going to take Chris.
Chris, you're on the air.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Pretty good. I know how much it pains you to talk Apple all the time without Peter there, so I figured I'd call and ask an Android question.
Oh, awesome.
And it may not be one you can answer. Has anybody heard anything about AT&T getting the ice cream sandwich update to, say, the Samsung phones, the Galaxy S2 specifically? It's been about to happen since March.
You know, if all that I've heard is that it is about to happen, and AT&T is notorious for being slow about this. So I think you just kind of have to get your zen on and wait for it. It's kind of part of the pain of being an Android user.
Oh, well. Okay. Well, that was it.
All right.
Thank you, guys.
All right. Wow.
So I mean, it's the pain of being an Android user if you're not using a Nexus phone. If you use a Nexus phone, they're better about it. Groovehouse, have you gotten on your Android phone, have you gotten any updates?
It's been a while, I think.
What was the last one you got?
Like Gingerbread, maybe? I don't know. It's old.
And that's a Galaxy S, right?
S, yeah, from Sprint.
Someone's leaked...
Yeah, Gingerbread, FC09.
Yeah.
Someone's leaked an ice cream sandwich ROM for the Galaxy Note. on AT&T. So that must mean that they're pretty close to getting something out there.
Hmm. All right.
Why are they so slow to introduce these things?
They're basically the updates have to be approved by both the carrier and the handset maker. So Samsung has, well, it's called TouchWiz, isn't it, Jay, on the Samsung, the little overlay?
Yeah.
They have their own overlay that's on top of Android that makes it look different. And then the carrier does its own things to it. And so they have to make everything work on both sides, and then it can be released. And it's a matter of resources, you know. They don't necessarily have the resources to be able to do that. The reason why Google can get updates out to its Nexus phones quickly is because it's just raw Android. And they don't have to worry about that kind of compatibility.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's the struggle. And it's weird. It's amazing how hodgepodge the whole updating of Android is for Android users, and then you lose it, all of it, once you go ahead and mod your device or root it, because they don't push updates to you anymore.
Right.
So.
Right. Same thing if you jailbreak an iPhone and then you try to.
Don't they push out to that? If you try to, you have to update that anyway.
Yeah, right. If you.
There's no over the air updates for Apple, is there?
Yes, there are now.
There are now.
Yep. Yep. They do over the air updates, and they're Delta updates, so they're small. They're not as big as they used to be. I've gotten a couple of them. It's really nice to do it that way. You still kind of want to do it over Wi-Fi, though, if you can.
Over Wi-Fi. All right. 713-526-5738. Groovehouse?
Yes.
Who's up next?
All right. Up next, we are going to take Clint.
Clint, you're on the air with Technology Bytes.
Hey, guys. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Pretty good. I have an MBAR question. a friend of mine uses webmail, which is MBARC, and I've just recently installed Microsoft Office for him, and he's using now Outlook. He probably has about maybe 3 gigs worth of emails and all that stuff. So I'm trying to import or export out of MBARC and import into Office or Microsoft Outlook.
Why would you do it that way?
Okay, tell me a better way.
Well, you would just configure Outlook to connect to his MBARC account. I believe you can do that. CenturyLink is what it's called now. Let me see. Outlook and settings for if you Google search how to, you know, MBARC Outlook, let's see. Outlook working with the new MBARC account. Here are the settings, username. You have to put in the incoming mail server and the outgoing mail server. You can actually connect Outlook straight to his MBARC account by bypassing the web interface and using Outlook as the interface to the MBARC. And if he's got any mail on the MBARC server, it should pull that all down.
It'll pull it all in? Really?
Mm-hmm. As far as I know, it will. As far as Outlook is concerned, it'll look at that mail store on the MBARC servers and say, I don't have a copy of any of these messages. Give it to me.
Interesting. Because he's got probably 20 folders on this left side that are separated from the main emails, that he wants to have those separate. It's like 3 years worth of emails.
I don't know enough about MBARC and how they do their business, but I would bet you that if you configured Outlook to connect to his MBARC account, it should look at that folder structure and pull that in. But I can't be certain of that. I know it'll do that with Gmail.
Make sure you set up for IMAP.
Actually, I did do that 2 weeks ago. It pulled all the emails in, but not as contacts, and not organized in the folders, which is going to take a long time for him to do. So I tried to export out of MBARC.
Does MBARC support exporting?
It does, actually. It does a T7G or something like that extension, but it stops at 1 gig, and it's about 3 gigs worth of stuff we have to import, but it stops at 1 gig, and that's it. Then I try to expand it, and it says the file's corrupt. So I'm thinking, why can't it do more than 1 gig?
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I wonder if you guys have, some stuff up your sleeve or something I don't know, never heard of, because I Googled it, and that's what I found out, but I can't go any further.
When you connected it from Outlook, did you actually use IMAP, or did you use a POP3 account?
I'm pretty sure it was the POP3, and it took like 14 hours.
Yeah, so here's the deal. Go back and do it with IMAP, because I don't believe that POP sees folder structures. It only reads from the straight inbox, and it pulls it down every time, and it doesn't actually sync with the mail server. So if you go in with IMAP should see those folders.
Now,
when you say I'm sorry, when you say IMAP, can you explain, expand on that
a
little?
There are two different protocols that you can use when you're configuring a mail client to go out and check for mail. One of them, the older one, is POP3, and it stands for Post Office Protocol. And what it does is it goes out and it says, hey, give me an index of all the messages that you have in the inbox. And it returns that, and they can say, hey, give me this one, give me this one, give me this one. So it downloads everything locally, but it takes a really long time. The other protocol that's out there is IMAP. What is IMAP? Internet message something protocol. But what that does is that actually will go and it will sync your mail client to whatever's on the server. So if you move a folder locally, if you move an email from one folder to another folder locally, it'll actually do that on the server. It mirrors it on the server. So the beautiful thing about that is if you've got multiple mail clients, if you do something on one mail client, it'll actually show up on the other because everything is going through that server. So it reads from the server.
Well, that sounds great.
Now, this question whether or not, first of all, we have to see whether Embark, I don't think Embark supports IMAP.
Oh, it doesn't?
Let's see.
I'm looking to see if it does.
I think they do, yeah, under support. They can do POP3, IMAP, or HTTP.
Okay, cool. So if you Google search IMAP, Embark, or CenturyLink, or whatever, and you should be able to find instructions on how to configure Outlook to connect to it that way.
Okay, but I'm doing that. I'm initially doing that from Outlook, you're saying, the IMAP stuff.
Yes, you're doing it inside of Outlook. So when you go into Outlook to configure a new mail account, you're going to configure it as IMAP. Usually it defaults to POP3.
So right.
Yeah, Outlook. It may not. It looks like some people have IMAP and some people don't.
It looks like, what I'm reading is it says some kind of accounts have it. Now, in terms of getting your contacts out of there, you can apparently CenturyLink allow you to export to a CSV file.
It does, but when I go to import it, I cannot for the life of me with all the variables. There's two stages to it with the Outlook, tab, comma tab, and all this kind of stuff. It doesn't do it. It's no matter what I try, it just will not import the contacts. It's weird.
Have you opened up the CSV file in Notepad just to see what the file looks like, to see if it's using some kind of weird delimiter or see what you can figure out about
it? I hope not, but it does import the first name, but I know there's more names in there, if you know what I mean.
Maybe. Let's see if there's any kind of a setting as to what kind of line feed to expect, whether it's like carriage return or line break or something, if there are any kind of settings in that to play around with.
Okay.
Look for that, because it may just be seeing that first line, and it did, you know, like if it comes out of Unix systems, sometimes they have different kind of line feeds at the end than just a Windows machine would, so you have to tell it to look for those different kinds.
Okay.
The
IMAP thing's got me intrigued, so I'll go back and try that. We've already imported everything, but it's all scattered.
Another option might be to set up a Gmail account,
mm-hmm.
and inside of Gmail, you can tell it to connect to another mail account and pull the mail into there.
And then from there, do it, and then
maybe connect Outlook to the Gmail account, and see if you can get it that way. If you can't get the Embark account configured for IMAP, is Embark, I'm guessing, is free?
Yes, it is free. Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I'm doing this from 2,000 miles away too, so I'm controlling his computer, I'm trying to help him out.
Well, there's a ton of. There's a way to get contacts to transfer them. I mean, if you Google search, save contacts, Embark, there's tons of people talking about it online. So I think you'll find the answer you're looking for. But check out the IMAP option. What I'm reading, what I saw when I was looking at it briefly was that only for their business class users do they support IMAP on their mailboxes, but maybe not for the free or personal users. That's one of the problems with some of the free mail services out there is they're not very fully featured.
Yeah, that's what I think. I do remember reading that you have to be some type of upper tier user to be able to take advantage of those features, I think.
One thing, it may save some time if he could call in and maybe just upgrade his account for 1 month or just do something like that just to get access to it. I'm scanning the CenturyLink.net stuff and I'm not seeing any IMAP CNAMEs. I'm seeing POP and stuff like that, but nothing that's answering any of the IMAP ports.
Okay.
So, but yeah, maybe upgrading the account. Is he wanting to get away from this completely? Like just let this account go?
Well, I hate to say this. I'm mainly a Mac person. He has a Mac at work, and he complains because it's the only Mac at work on a PC server, and he's having problems with the Mac. Of course, no one knows how to maintain the Mac, and much less operate it. But now he's anti-Mac, and he wants to, at home on his laptop, he wants to have better control of his emails and attachments. And I said, well, let's just install Office so you can have Outlook, and instead of doing webmail, download the emails to your computer. So
it may be worth it for him to get an to get the pro account or get whatever kind of account he can that'll have IMAP, because doing that through POP, he's never going to have that folder.
Now he can just have his email. I mean, obviously he can just get his email and he'll lose his folder structure, and then he can go be anti Mac with somebody else.
yeah. I'm a buy user, so it doesn't matter to me. But
right. Well, I mean, the thing is that if the end user is complaining about the platform or has an elitist attitude about his platform, but he doesn't know how to use that platform, I've got no sympathy for that person.
No, I know what you're saying. He's 70 years old, and I'm surprised he's using a laptop anyway, but he's doing good as it is. But and then he goes to the iMac, and he's like, oh, my God, what is this? It's a totally new environment.
Right. Well, that's, and curmudgeon is a whole other thing, so.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate your help, guys. I'll try that IMAP stuff and check it out and see what happens.
All right. Good luck. Thanks for your call.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. 713-526-5738. We've got about 10 minutes before the top of the hour, so I think we can get another call or so in before we have to take a short break. But if you want to get in the queue for the rest of the show, you can call up 713-526-KPFT. Groovehouse?
Yes.
Who's up?
Up next, we're going to take Jerry.
Jerry, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
All right, what's up?
I came in kind of at the end of a school administrator talking about technology prices and having enough equipment for students.
Yeah?
And I was going to contribute my 2 cents. I'm a system administrator for community college, and what my son uses at his school, they're heavy into the Google Docs. So they don't provide computers per se, an adequate amount, kind of like we do at the college level. But they're heavy into the cloud computing, Google Docs / Google storage, et cetera, et cetera. And I was thinking, why not? It might be an opportunity to go in the direction of something like a Chromebook, where they're, I saw them for $300 today online. It's equivalent to the cost of an iPad. And I think given the ease of use part of it, as long as you have adequate networking, should be sufficient.
The latest generation of Chromebooks generally run a little more than that. What you may have seen were closeouts on some of the older ones. But
right.
But the newest Chrome OS is really nice and actually now has a real desktop. The previous version of Chrome OS was just a browser.
Right.
So that would be a really good option, because you can, a student gets home, sits down at the family computer, pulls up any browser and immediately goes and starts working again. The one downside is that schools have to make sure that they have adequate Wi-Fi and adequate networking throughout the building, which in a lot of older schools is not always easy to do.
Right. I mean, it's not without its own hiccups, but right. I'm saying as far as if you're talking about using an iPad, you're going to run into those same issues trying, vying for connectivity.
Right.
And I think, honestly, using something like Citrix or an associated product on an iPad ends up being less user-friendly in the long run than going in the direction of something that runs right off the cloud, like a Chromebook.
Well, you could also, but you'd have both options available to you, I would suspect. I mean, I think there's a large movement to actually just use the functionality of a tablet and this, but this person was talking that specifically Microsoft applications or Office documents.
I got you. But, even if you're talking about Office applications, that's already done, right? I mean, we've been doing that in Linux for a long time. But as far as...
But not on the iPad.
But not on the iPad, right? Correct.
I'm not in the education system. I realize there are a lot of challenges for that. I know that some of the higher-end schools or the private schools that, the cost of an iPad is worked into the tuition for a lot of the early grades now. So that seems to be the way things are going.
Right. Yeah, even we are adopting it heavily where I'm at. But we're now adopting a more virtualized desktop environment using VMware. So
right.
But, for K-12, I was just thinking, if you're weighing in options, iPad, some sort of iPad virtualization versus something that can handle, it may not be an actual Microsoft application, but you can do a lot of the same work.
So you just need to hand them their number two pencil and an eraser.
Yeah,
and
right.
Paper and say, shut the hell up, you whiny.
Yeah, either way, that's my 2 cents. I don't want to take up more of y'all's time.
No, appreciate that. Appreciate that. All right, thank you.
Y'all have a good one. Thank you.
All right. So 6 minutes till the top of the hour. I guess we'll just play. We'll take another call. We may have to put you on hold in the middle of it while we take a break. But let's see who's up next. Groovehouse. Can't be inflicted for that one.
I'm telling you. All right. Up next, we are going to take Matthew.
Matthew, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hey, listen. AVG, the anti-malware thing has taken over Google on my Firefox on one of my computers.
Google on my Firefox.
And there's nothing. I tried everything to get rid of it. And the reason I want to get rid of it because when I do a search, it never brings me in the direction where I want to go.
That's not AVG that's doing that to you. It sounds to me like you've got a browser hijack going on.
Uh-huh.
You need to check out a program called Malware Bytes.
Okay.
We offer it on our website at geekradio.com under the Spywares link. And
I've got that. I run Malware Bytes. I've got it. I keep it updated all the time.
And it's not detecting anything?
No.
Try Hitman Pro then. If you've got there's a specific Google browser hijack that can be very hard to remove, but Hitman Pro is well now used to detect and get rid of that. But you know, we talk about spyware all the time, and if you read our spyware page at geekradio.com, I offer some tools that include Hitman Pro, Malware Bytes, to try to get rid of it, but it can be very difficult to clean.
So when you click on something that, say, comes up in the results, you don't go to the place you want to go to?
Right. If I do a search, and it gives me everything that it wants to give me. I mean, it gives me stuff in the general direction. But not what I really want. Like, I was looking for a bills bondsman today, and he gave me a few bills bondsmen. But I went to one of my other computers with the Google site, and they gave me everything local.
Right. I mean, but is it taking you to an actual bail bondsman site, or is it taking you to some other site?
Yeah, it takes me to a bail bondsman site, but it's like a totally different than the ones that I get on Google, in other words. You know, it's like...
This happens in Firefox? What about Internet Explorer?
I never use Internet Explorer. Well,
you try that and tell me if the same... You know, find out if the same thing is happening there. Because you might just need to uninstall and reinstall Firefox.
Okay, what I'm saying is this only happens on one...
One computer, while you're using Firefox. And we don't know why that is just yet. Okay. So we want to troubleshoot this, to try to understand it a little bit better.
Okay.
This is what I would try. I would try using Internet Explorer to see if the same thing happens. That will tell you whether or not it is a Firefox issue or a computer issue.
Okay.
All right?
All right, guys.
All right, good luck. Thanks for your call. Bye. All right. I saw you pressing that red button.
Yeah, I was about to.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, we got about 45 seconds.
I just try to follow the rules.
You know, you're a rebel without a reb.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, well, we are going to have to take a short break here and do some station business. I should let you know that you are listening to Technology Bytes. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Dwight.
And he's
Groovehouse.
And we'll be right back after this. I can't stretch it any longer.
So. You can't?
Nope.
Not even just a few more seconds?
Not even like nine, eight, maybe seven more seconds?
Just, you know, I don't know. Maybe we could stretch it.
We could go all the way up to the point where you push that.
Are you interested in volunteering at KPFT? If so, come to our volunteer training session Friday, June 29th, 12 noon, or Saturday, June 30th at 3 p.m. located at KPFT Pacifica Radio, 419 Lovett Boulevard. We have opportunities in the news department and graphic design. In the production department, you can learn radio engineering or production assistance, fundraising, groundskeeping, building maintenance, or meet people and help us at any of the many events that KPFT does in the community. Add KPFT to your resume. Show the world you give of yourself and your time. Go to kpft.org and fill out a volunteer request form. Or call Anthony at 713-526-4000, extension 301. Come to the volunteer training session at the station on June 29th, 12 noon, or Saturday, June 30th at 3 p.m. You're listening to KPFT.
Many companies will match gifts made to nonprofit organizations. A matching gift from your company will help KPFT preserve independent music, arts, news, and views for generations to enjoy. Participating in your company's matching gift program is as easy as 1, 2, 3. Step 1, make a gift to KPFT. Pledge today at kpft.org. Step 2, contact your human resources office for eligibility requirements and to obtain a matching gift form. Many companies match the gifts of retirees, spouses, and surviving spouses. Step 3, fill out the employee portion of the form completely. Send the form to KPFT, Attention Matching Gifts, 419 Lovett, Houston, Texas, 77006. Your gift to KPFT could double if your company has a matching gift program. Help out your community radio station today. This is KPFT Houston.
Hey, Barrett. What's happening?
I don't know.
Well, room around town.
We interrupt this skit to bring you...
Baritone! Yeah. That means it's time for... Baritone! Yeah. Anyway. Take it away, Barrett.
All right. Summer's here, and with it may come the urge to stay indoors out of the Houston heat and humidity. Given the disproportionate number of hot days we have here in Texas, we also have the opportunity to get more done, whereas someone in our California listening area may only write some prose or a poem while ducking the dog days of summer. A Texan could knock out an entire novel before the heat index deeps back beneath the red. Does anyone actually know what the difference is between poetry and prose is?
Poetry isn't it kind of structured, where prose is more of a embellished English.
Well, we'll get back to that. I guess
a
little more in a minute.
Question?
It's a rhetorical question for now. We'll get back to that. But for now, know that once you've done the easy bit of authoring a book, John Glaver can get you through the rough stuff, which is getting it published electronically. So I think the order's reversed on the difficulty there. John Glaver is giving a talk on exactly that this Saturday at the Houston Area Apple Users Group monthly meeting. General meetings start at 9 in the morning, with the main presentation taking place at 11, allowing you to leave the land of the red street signs slowly and cautiously by 1 p.m. The meeting takes place at the Bel Air Civic Center at 7008 South Rice Avenue in Bel Air, Texas. This is a destination you may want to return to as the summer swap meet is coming up in July, and our own Dwight Silverman plans to talk rumors and reality when it comes to the new iPad in August. True? Rumor? Or is that reality? Are you talking?
It's news to me.
You're on the, they've got your picture on the website. You're speaking there. That's what they're advertising.
Okay.
Coming up in August.
Because I was sick. No, I was sick and had to wave off, and so they were going to reschedule it, but I don't actually recall another date. But that's okay.
Oh, it's...
I may be, you know...
Well, wait just for a second. Yeah, go to hog.org if you want to see Dwight's picture. It's going to be the next one up. Swap meet Saturday, July 21st. And the new iPad, When Rumor Becomes Reality by Dwight Silverman, Saturday, August 18th.
Okay, I'll be there. I may have agreed to that. I don't recall. I was sick and feverish.
Thank God you tuned in to Barrett.
Yeah, I'm good you're here.
Thank you, Barrett.
You're welcome. So hit www.haaug.org for details, directions, and the summer lineup of meetings and presentations. Of course, you wouldn't want to lose your ability to surf the net while stuck indoors this summer, which is an actual concern if you happen to be harboring the DNS changer malware that has found its way into millions of workstations around the world. DNS, the domain name system, is a distributed naming system for computers on the internet. DNS servers take requests from clients in the form of domain names, then hand out the appropriate IP addresses for that domain. This saves you from having to remember that 173.193.176.178 is the appropriate IP address for the Geek Radio site. It also makes it possible to stack multiple domains on a single IP address, making things such as virtual name-based hosting possible on web servers. So all this would be hunky-dory if some shady cracker/criminal types hadn't created a piece of malware that redirects your computer's DNS requests away from legitimate DNS servers and instead to DNS servers that they control. So what were they after? Bank account info? Your grandmother's recipe for chocolate chip cookies. Actually, they're money. Excuse me, let me start over. Actually, advertising is where the money's at, and to a lesser extent, iTunes tracks. In Operation Ghost Click, the FBI eventually caught the ring of six Estonians responsible, and then determined that I've got to justify my stuff, and then determined that taking down the servers would rob millions of people of access to any website whose IP address they didn't already have memorized. So on March 12th of this year, they replaced the compromised servers with clean servers that are scheduled to go offline Monday, July 9th. What does this mean to you? If you've been infected with the DNS changer malware, and it's been out in the wild since 2007, you probably don't know it, especially now that the FBI is controlling your browsing experience. So we'll have a link up to the FBI page, as well as a link that will tell you whether or not you're connected to the DNS servers in question by the end of the show. But for now, let's revisit that prose and poetry problem. Brendan Behan, an Irish drinker with a writing problem, reportedly summed it up with the following rhyme. I've got to be careful with this one. There was a young fellow named Rollox who worked for Farrier Pollux. As he walked on the strand with his girl by the hand, the tide came up to his knees. Now that's prose. If the tide had been in, it would have been poetry. That's it for your Irish education, and that's that for Barrett Time.
All right. And also in the news, however you pronounce his name, Linus Torvald received the 2012 Millennium Technology Prize.
That's awesome.
Which he shared with
stem cell
Dr. Shinya Yamanaka, stem cell scientist. But, you know, Linus doesn't come up in the news that often. But there he was.
Linus
Torvald. Or however you say that. All right.
Where'd calls go?
Where'd all the calls go? Where'd the calls go? Crib House?
I don't know. They didn't want to wait.
You hung up on it.
I didn't hang up.
You said, get out of here.
Nope. One dropped, and then the other one dropped, and then someone called in and never got back on the line.
713-526-5738. We start with a clean slate at the top of the second hour here on Technology Bites. Whoever calls in first goes up first.
Hopefully.
Maybe. Maybe, unless it's Dwight. Well, I don't think Dwight really believes that.
Dwight, can I check the phones again?
Well, we know they work. So we apologize for having to take that short break at the top of the hour. Let me remind you, you're listening to Technology Bites. We're back now. Barrett Time. KPFT, if you're listening in Houston. 713-526-5738. If you're listening live on a Wednesday night, you are welcome to call in. We'll be happy to answer your computer questions, talk tech with you, whatever you need. 713-526-5738 is the number to call to be on the air. Groovehouse is standing by to take your call and get you in the queue. Well, I was looking forward. There we go. Somebody's calling in. 713-526-5738. Make Groovehouse scramble. So let's see. So I'm not going to get a new MacBook. I'm not going to get a new iMac. I'm still holding out hope that I'm going to get an iPhone. I got a nice email from T-Mobile reminding me or letting me know that I could get a free phone, which I'm sure is tied to signing a contract, which expired this month.
Well,
a discounted phone, not a free phone.
So does Verizon's new shared data plans interest you at all?
Cynthia has a dumb phone that she pays, I think, $3 a month for. All she has it for is just to be able to receive calls. Now, that brings up an interesting topic because she has an iPad, but she does not subscribe to a data plan, even though she can. And this is what Cynthia said to me, and coming from a computer Luddite like herself, she said, the iPad needs to be a phone. It needs to have that capability. It doesn't necessarily need to be someone's primary phone or anything, but it needs the
ability. It can.
Only over a data connection using voice over IP.
So what's the problem?
Well, if you don't subscribe to a data plan, you only have connectivity on the Wi-Fi.
Skype.
But if you're outside of if you're driving down the road and you don't have a data plan enabled on your iPad and you have a wreck and you need to call somebody, you don't get to do that.
Then enable the data plan. Then that's like paying for a phone, like paying for a phone line.
So you're saying use something like Skype.
Six of one, half dozen the other, right?
How reliable would that be as a phone service? Like if I needed to call her, would her iPad ring?
Yes, you call her Skype number. As long as she has it running.
She was logged in, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep. So
do you have to pay for, so you have to pay for the data plan and you have to pay for the Skype minutes, right?
You pay for the Skype minutes, except if you're calling from Skype to Skype, you would not.
Right, if you're calling from Skype to Skype, but if you're calling from a phone to Skype,
yes.
Does the Skype person get billed for that? Do you get free incoming calls on Skype?
I don't think so. I think if it comes in from a landline or from a traditional phone, you're charged. So, because they dial your Skype.
I don't know why, but I have the sense that an IP phone is just not as reliable as a cellular phone. And I don't base that on anything except that it just seems to me like...
Well, the call quality we have with a lot of our callers, it seems like, you know, every other one. Maybe we don't know the people that aren't having issues, you know, that aren't cutty, you know, kind of jittery. But a lot of people that call in, at least on the show, it's very obvious that they're on a...
The times that I have used Skype to call somebody on a landline phone, it was an excellent connection on both sides. Now, I was connected on Wi-Fi, and it was a good... I was at a stationary location. One of the times it was at Coffee Grounds on the back patio over their Wi-Fi. So
maybe as an experiment, since Cynthia has been needing a reason to enable her data plan, we'll sign her up with a data plan and we'll get her a Skype account on her iPad. And then we'll just test that out as a theory. Just I'll call her now and again on her iPad and see what happens. Because she won't buy a smartphone. She'll, at this point, unless they force one on her, she has no need for a smartphone. She's got a dumb phone. And the only reason she carries a cell phone at all is just for emergencies. She's not a texter. She doesn't talk, you know, call people and just chat.
Well, if you want to make it as easy as possible for her, I'd get her a Bluetooth headset. Use Bluetooth headset to answer the phone. Or
there would be a struggle there, I think.
Or all you have to do is put on your ear and press the button on the ear. And that's the simplest thing. The other thing you do is you can actually get like a Bluetooth stereo headset.
Now,
you can also use that to listen to music. Or I believe that there are stereo handsets for a Bluetooth where you essentially, it looks like it's Bluetooth, but it looks like an old-fashioned phone handset. You pick it up and talk.
This may be an experiment that we need to try, because it could get her to justify the data plan. How much data does a voice call...
Well, that's a question that I was curious about. I don't know how much. Voice is not much. It doesn't... It's lo-fi, so it's, you know, it doesn't have to be stereo. It's not...
But I wonder... You know, and again... She doesn't use the phone that much, so it wouldn't be a lot. Mm-hmm. But
would not be threatening to her data cap.
Data cap. All right. Well, that might be an experiment. That might be a worthy experiment, and we'll see how that goes. All right. Right now, Groovehouse has got calls screened for us.
Yes, I do.
And he will tell us who's up next.
Yes, I will.
By the length of the holding.
Yes, I can.
All right, Groovehouse.
Yes.
Who's up next?
All right, up next, the second half of the show, we are going to take Ed.
Ed, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hello, gentlemen. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Another day in paradise.
Yes,
sure. Super quick question for you. I have a an office PC on a wireless router, and things have been great, perfect for months and months and months. And here of lately, it seems like a daily occurrence. I'll be working online, and next thing you know, things are just get real slow. And what it is, is that the router drops me. And, you know, the old trick of having to, you know, you unplug the power, and then you plug it back in, and it resets, and then it's good. And this seems to happen, you know, it was like once every few days. Well, now it happens every single day. What do you think's going on? Any possible suggestions?
So you're saying that you're finding that you need to reboot the router once a day?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And that is it that everybody is losing their connectivity?
Well, there's only I've got three computers on the LAN, but there's only one person in the office now. You know, economic downturn, right? So it's just me on one PC.
So. But rebooting the router solves the problem every time.
Every time. That is the fix.
How old is the router?
It's pretty new. I replaced it. I believe it's a Netgear, and I'd say that router's probably about 6 months old.
Have you checked for new firmware?
Suggesting. No, I've not done that.
You should do that.
That'd be worthwhile.
Particularly if it's a new model, because oftentimes they'll release a new model, find bugs, and then update it with new firmware.
Gosh,
and sometimes just patching the firmware sometimes just gives the router the lobotomy it needs to get back in line and start working right. But if that doesn't do it, I mean, that was certainly that's a worthy experiment and has a good chance of solving the problem. But if it doesn't, it might be worthwhile to get on phone with the support for the manufacturer and see if it's a problem, if they need to replace it.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, once again, you guys have been helpful. Thanks so much.
Oh, don't forget to update your drivers on your wireless on your laptop, too.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. It isn't a laptop. It's a PC, but that makes sense.
Update the drivers for the wireless device. That's also worth checking into.
Okay, firmware and drivers. Excellent.
All right.
Okay, guys.
All right, thanks
for being there for us.
Oh, no problem. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Good night.
All right, 713-526-5738. If you want to be on the air with us tonight here on Technology Bites, we are taking your calls. Groovehouse is actually taking your calls and putting you into the queue where you line up like proper ladies and gentlemen and wait your turn. So who's up next, Groovehouse?
All right, up next, we're going to take JR.
JR.
Hello, guys. I have an excessively powerful computer.
Well,
way more than I have need to do what I do. But anyway, that's fun, and it's cheaper than a big truck. So I can't seem to get the 64-bit version of Internet Explorer, the default browser. Anytime I can bring it up from the menu.
Right, but you can't make it be the...
Anything else wants to go to the browser, it pulls up the 32-bit version.
Now, I will tell you, in my own personal Windows computing world, I ignore the 64-bit version of Internet Explorer, mostly because it doesn't do Flash. So, I'm wondering if there is not a Flash player for the 64-bit version. Still, the last I checked, there wasn't. And it's been a while since I looked because I wrote it off at that point. But I'm wondering if IE 32-bit is the default because it's the most likely going to work with whatever is making the call to the web browser.
It exists now.
It does. Yeah. So there is Flash for the 64-bit. Is there any other lack of functionality then in the 64-bit version of Internet Explorer?
Well, I can't find it. I mean, my 64-bit works fine.
Okay. So you're using Windows 7?
The latest version, Windows 7, that's right.
And when you go into the default program settings, do you not have the option to change your HTML and things like that over to the 64-bit version?
No, it just says Internet Explorer, and you know it gives you a little picture. It doesn't. I mean, I've gone to that default program selector thing, and it doesn't. I can't get from there to wherever the 64-bit version is.
Well, the 32-bit version is going to probably be in Program Files x86, and let's see. I just Googled Internet Explorer 64-bit default, and let's see. The 64-bit version of Internet Explorer 9, 8, and 7 cannot be set as the default browser.
Oh, okay.
According to what I'm reading, if you would like, I would like.
I haven't been yet, so.
You can put a shortcut to the 64-bit in your store. You cannot set the 64-bit as a default program.
So that there's no way to just set for any link, say in an email, that it will bring up the 64-bit. That won't happen.
Yeah, so I'm looking here. The differences between the 32-bit, 64-bit of Internet Explorer that are included in the X64-based version of Windows Server XP Professional, blah, blah, blah. That's a little older of an article. But how do you make, let me check this other article here. That was one thing I read where the person said, you can't, I want, rather than not do it. What I'm reading, you can't do it. You can't.
Well,
I don't even know what's the benefit in IE of 64-bit.
I don't know.
I know that a lot of people get on this 64-bit kick. You know, they say, "Well, my operating 64-bit. I've got a hardware that supports 64-bit. I want 64-bit." And for example, Microsoft Office, the 64-bit version of Microsoft Office, even Microsoft says, unless you're running spreadsheets that are greater than 2 gigs, you probably don't want to run the 64-bit version of Office because Outlook doesn't work with all the plugins. It's actually crippled compared to the 32-bit version. So you gain nothing, and in fact, you lose something by running the 64-bit version. And when it comes to a program like Internet Explorer, I can't imagine you get that much of a performance boost.
I don't deny it's a silly question.
No, I'm happy to discuss it. It's I think that, you know, I just go with the 32-bit version and be done with it. But according to method two, if you want to change the default Internet Explorer from 32-bit to 64-bit, you may perform the following steps. You can change the program Windows uses by default to open different file extension. Here's how: click Start, Default Programs. Click on Associate, browse to all the extensions where Internet Explorer set as default. Now click on or change. Now click on and browse and go to /program/Internet Explorer and select it. I'm thinking that the version of Internet Explorer that's a 64-bit version is in the folder called Program Files. When you're going into your default programs,
yeah,
and you actually, you know, it shows you a list of them. But you can also browse.
Okay.
And you need to go to the location where the 64-bit version of IE is located. And that's in Program Files /Internet Explorer, according to what I'm reading. I don't have a Windows computer in front of me. The 32-bit version of Internet Explorer is going to be in Program Files (x86) close parentheses.
Okay. Shows me how to do it, and now I have to decide whether to do it.
Right.
Thank you very much, Lee.
All right, good luck. Thanks for your call, JR. Bye. All right. I let my chair kind of go down. I press that lever that causes the chair to shrink down.
Yeah.
And now I don't want to be shrunk down anymore, and I can't figure out how to go back up.
You have to get out of the chair.
I think you have to get out of the chair.
He's out of the chair, and he's raising it. He's up again.
All right.
There he is, back on top.
I just gave my chair the old heave-ho. All right. Now that I'm riding high again, back in the saddle, at table height, like an adult.
You were sitting at the kids' table there for a minute.
You know, it was an adult table that had been kind of provisioned as a kid's table. All right, so hand me the next turkey.
You got it. It's salmon. Salmon, you're on the air.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good.
Okay, good. I'm going to just give you my question real fast, and then I'll hang up so y'all guys can answer it.
Okay.
I guess it's a two-part question. I'm on a Mac, and I've been on it for 3 years, and before that I was on a PC. And my Mac, you know, it works just as good as it did the day I got it. And the reason I switched over to Macs is because my PC was running so slow from viruses and malware.
Oh, no.
Oh,
we lost him. All right. Well, his question was going to be about Macs and viruses. And
one of them was, is it better now than it was back then, or is it worse now than it was back then? That was one of the
questions. For the Mac?
For the Mac, as far as viruses.
It's worse now for the Mac, but even now that it's worse, it's still not that bad. Although the last virus that was reported that came out for the Mac They estimated how many computers were infected with it? Half a million?
At some point, about 600,000. Yeah.
So, yeah, about 600,000 Mac users were infected with this one particular virus. But apparently the virus was nothing you would even notice unless you went and checked for it. So, I don't know. It's not that bad, but somebody else did a comparison that said if you had 600,000 Macs, based on the percentage of Mac users, it was still a pretty high number.
Yes.
Because if you compared that to the number of PCs, you know, the per capita or whatever they say, you know, bits, the parts per million, that it was still a high number of infections. So if you are the kind of person who used a Windows computer and found yourself running up afoul of viruses and malware quite frequently, then chances are you could, that same behavior could translate into getting infected on a Mac. So if you're not, you know, if you're just kind of, you know, if you're the kind of person that clicks on links when they come in the email and goes traipsing off into the web wonderland without much consideration of where you might be going, there are some antivirus programs for the Mac. What are your, Sophos is one of them, S-O-P-H-O-S. ClamAV is another
one.
Yeah,
though ClamAV is actually not very good.
Not very good?
Yeah. There, Sophos has a free one. There's iAntivirus, which I've used before and is pretty good. I take them, I put them on and off of my machine, and at the moment I'm not running one.
Yeah.
But there are a variety of some that are free. And of course, Norton actually makes one that a lot of Mac users use, particularly Macs in companies run and schools run Norton.
Norton. Okay. Yeah, I'm not currently running an AV on my Mac, so. You know, living dangerously, but not that dangerously because it's a Mac. All right, Groovehouse.
Yes.
Let me go with the phone number one more time since we do have time left in the show and only a couple of people in the queue. 713-526-5738. 713-526-KPFT. If you want to be on the air with Technology Bites, we'd be happy to take your call. We've got plenty of open lines. Groovehouse is anxious and actually slobbering to get on the phone and wants to talk to you and get you in the queue. So, what's up? Who's up next, Groovehouse?
All right, up next, we're going to take Don.
Don, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hey, good evening, gentlemen, and you too, Jay. We're all here tonight, looks like. I got three short questions here that I think will help everybody. These are general questions that I think will help a lot of people.
Oh, okay.
The first concerns the fact that I'm kind of shopping for a new laptop, and I've been looking, and it appears that some of the big shops in town, Micro Center, a couple others, are starting to get the laptops with the new Generation 3 chipsets in them, you know, the Ivy Bridge Generation 3, and, you know, i3, i5, i7s. And I'm just kind of wondering if I should wait maybe a month or two more when these are more prevalent in the machines and they phase out the second generation. Because the reason I ask that is because I do have an application. I'm not a gamer or anything like that, but I do have an application that... It's a big number crunching application, and it right now it eats up about 90% of the processor in my laptop, and I could stand a lot more speed. So I'm looking forward to the possibility that maybe the Generation 3 chipsets will give me a lot more number crunching quickness to it. And I did do some homework. I mean, I checked a couple of speed sites, you know, for the Intel chip of me, if I waited for the Generation 3s to really to penetrate the market and go out and buy a laptop. So maybe you guys could give me some feedback there.
Well, the processors aren't going to speed up just because they've saturated the market. The processor you buy now, unless they update them with a newer version, is going to be the same speed. I wouldn't worry about that at the moment. You know, if you need my advice has always been, if you need a notebook now, buy it now. Don't wait for the next big thing, because you'll always wait for the next
thing. That's right. I mean, you always wait for a new feature or a new speed of something.
And these Ivy Bridge processors are really fast. I mean, it's what's in this Retina display MacBook Pro that I'm playing with, and it's incredibly fast, and I'm sure it is in a Windows machine as well. If you need one now, I just get one now.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, one of the things, you know, beyond CPUs and the chipsets that seems to be speeding things up are the solid-state drives.
Mm-hmm.
That just really
well,
is revolutionary.
Yeah, Jay, my application doesn't even tax the drive. It just uses the processing power through a 3.0 USB connection, and it really eats up the processor. But anyway, I understand what you guys are saying, and the Generation 2 chip machines, though, are going to start getting a lot cheaper because they're going to start dumping these laptops on the market right now that have the old generation chipset in them. So that could be, you know, it could be worth waiting a month or two for that to happen to get a really good deal on that. Second quick question, while over the years you guys have touted a lot of different protection for machines like AVG and Malwarebytes, which I'm looking at my machine here in front of me, Jay. I've got all that. But I've also got SpyBot, a version of SpyBot, which is the latest one, which is not too recent because they don't update very often. Is SpyBot still worth having on?
I haven't played with SpyBot in a long time, I must say. My three favorite tools right now have been Malwarebytes, Hitman Pro, and CombiFix.
Well, and there's no reason why I shouldn't go ahead and remove SpyBot and get it off here because I don't really think I need it. In fact,
are you finding a lot of spyware on your system? Is
no,
that something you're having a problem
never,
with?
Never.
My philosophy tends to be, when it comes to spyware software, if I'm not having an ongoing problem with constantly getting infected with spyware, then I just keep one program around, you know, Malwarebytes.
Yeah.
And if I start to sense that there might be a problem, then I'll kick off a scan.
Yeah, I feel the same way. Plus, like the SpyBot, I don't think it's as up to date as Malwarebytes on a lot of things. And I just, because they don't, I don't think they stay on top of their updates the same way.
They used to,
but they've been outpaced now by things, I think, like Malwarebytes and other programs like that. So I'll dump it off the system here. I don't really, it's just something cluttering up my desktop and get it out of there. And lastly, this kind of goes back to question number one, waiting for Windows 8 as opposed to the 7 system that we got right now. I mean, in buying a new laptop, any feedback on that?
Unless you're going to go with a touch-based machine, I don't see Windows 8 as being that compelling.
Right.
So I wouldn't wait for that either.
Okay. All right. Very good, guys. Thanks for your time tonight.
All right, thanks for
your
call.
Thank you.
Yeah, in terms of waiting for operating systems, I mean, I've still got users in my environment that are using XP still. You know, it's just really, unless you know if there's a feature coming up in Windows 8 that's going to revolutionize your applications, I don't see any reason to wait for it.
And there are enough changes in the way Windows 8 works that are going to really drive people crazy, like the lack of the start button. You go to a Metro screen to launch something. One of the things I think that people will really be upset about is on the Windows 8 start screen, which is, you know, different from the start menu, not all of your applications are there. If you want to find your application, you have to go to the search screen and search for it by typing it in. That is going to drive people up the wall. And I don't see any real way that this is going to be compelling to people who are upgrading their existing machines. I think if you buy a new machine and you get it, you'll learn it and put up with it. And if you get a tablet, I think it'll be quite good. I think people who have tablets will like it. But I can see that Microsoft runs a real risk of Windows 8 becoming the next Vista.
Eek. Well, it wouldn't hurt my feelings to skip an operating system refresh in the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we just kind of get...
I think that will happen. I think, you know, most businesses right now are just now...
Settling into Windows 7 because, right, you know, businesses like the company I work for, the only reason we're really even... I'm sure we would have considered it, but the driving force has been what the computers have been shipping with and what the hardware will support. You know, so if there's no driver support for XP for the new hardware, you have to go with Windows 7. But I could easily see us skipping the next operating system, which would be fine by me. Except, of course, the happy-go-lucky people who think that they know everything and run out and install whatever they can find and then come to the help desk and say, my computer doesn't work anymore. All right, 713-526-5738, and I replied to your email, Dwight, and that's fixed. So
yay,
get back to work. All right, Groovehouse?
Yes.
Who's up next?
All right, up next, we are going to take Miles.
Miles, you're on the air.
Hello. Yes, how y'all doing tonight?
Good, how are you?
All right, I got a problem with trying to log on to a bank account. And it keeps asking you the security questions instead of letting you go to the logon page. And I talked to the people at the bank, and they said that it's in the computer. It's not in their software. It's not in their system that's causing that, because they're saying the bank account software recognizes the computer as a public computer. And the lady told me that it's something to do with either the computer maker or the virus software or the... or the IP.
Now, are you saying that can you get logged into your bank account?
Yeah, but you got to always answer.
Okay. You always have to answer the security question, because what happens is that when everything's working the way it's supposed to, the bank website sets a cookie on your computer, and so it recognizes that computer when it comes back, and it doesn't necessarily prompt you for these security questions. It just lets you log in. But anytime I use a new computer, like I want to access my bank account from a computer I've never used before, it asks me the security question, forces me to receive a security code and so forth like that. Now, the question is, why is your computer not doing this? Have you installed any software that's designed to clean up your browsing history, or have you installed CCleaner? Do you scan your system with registry cleaners or anything like that?
No, we don't do that with that computer. It's just the only updates it gets is like if HP sends an update or updates the McAfee virus scan.
Okay.
And then she said there may be something that your IP guy might, your IP company might be doing to your computer, or it just doesn't make any sense. And then she adamantly insisted that their bank, their software does not put any cookies on your computer. She said every time the bank software sees that computer, recognizing it as a public computer.
Like as though a computer that's at a library or something?
No, the computer is at my house.
When they say that it's seeing it as a public computer.
Yes, like, and that forces their program to ask for the security questions, answers to the security.
Well, you have something installed on your computer that makes it look like it is used generically by a lot of people. And so that could be some kind of anonymizing software that doesn't allow... She says that they don't place cookies on it, but I doubt that. And it makes it look like you can't save anything or write anything to it that's permanent. And so it's doing that every time. You do have something on that machine, and if... It's probably, we don't know what the configuration of your system is, and I don't think you could adequately describe it. So you may want to get somebody to look at it, a professional to look at it, and take a look at what you have installed on there.
What another option for you might be to try a different web browser.
Okay.
Like install Chrome or Firefox and see if you can access your bank using that.
Right. Well, the whole thing is this computer worked the way it should up until about 2 or 3 months ago. It worked for like 8, 10 months, a year.
Right.
It was never a problem, and then it became a problem here within the last...
Is it possible that your version of Internet Explorer got updated recently?
I don't know. I tried to find the cookies and tried to see if there was any cookies from that, certain website or that bank. I couldn't find anything in there. I don't know if that I think it's IE9 on that computer because it's a Windows 7 computer.
I was thinking that
I know what the problem is.
You do?
I know what the problem is. On IE9, when you go to your bank's website, in the address bar up at the top, to the right of it, there's an icon that looks like a broken page.
Yeah.
Click that icon.
Yeah.
That is called the compatibility button. And what happens is some websites don't recognize IE9 or don't know what to do with it. It's got something in it that doesn't know what to do with it. We've had this problem at the Chronicle with some of our software where people who are trying to use the version of WordPress that we have, the software we have, they can't save anything. It can't cause anything to be saved. And so they'll paste something in and nothing happens. This, I bet, is that same problem. It sounds like the same kind of problem.
Yeah, I was going to suggest downgrading to IE8, but Dwight's suggestion is actually better. So when you go to your bank site, check, will it stay in compatibility?
Yes, once you click it, it will stay there.
Anytime you go back to it, will it revert to compatibility mode?
Yes, yep.
So there's what you need to try. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. There's one other part I don't know if you're familiar with it, if I left it out. After you answer the security question, there's two options down there. This is a private computer, register it, or this is a public computer, don't register it. It's got the two option buttons down there.
And you're choosing private, correct?
We do.
It may be that the website's not accepting the information properly from Internet Explorer 8 or 9 or whatever this is. So try the compatibility mode. Go back to the site. When you first load it, change it to compatibility mode, then fill out your security question, check that proper button, and see if it doesn't if it doesn't stick.
All right. I appreciate it, man.
All right, good luck. Let us know if it works out.
I sure will.
Thanks, Miles. Have a good night. Bye.
So I've had this problem repeatedly with people who are freelancers who are working from home and working in our blog
software.
I hate
them so much.
It's happened several times, and like the second time I forgot that we fixed it that way, and I spent like half a day with this person before I finally remembered, oh yeah, that button. Now I remember that button. and I have run across issues with IE9 myself where I've hit that button and that has fixed a lot of things. So that's something to try if you have problems.
I need to remember that
IE9
for some stuff too.
Yeah.
All right. 713-526-5738. We've got 20 minutes left in the show, 16 minutes, give or take an outro. We got two calls in the queue. So we've got time and open lines. If you want to be on the air with Technology Bites, you can dial us up at 713-526-KPFT. Talk to Groovehouse, get a warm fuzzy, go on hold, get in the queue. All right, Groovehouse.
Yes.
Who's the warm fuzzy?
The next warm fuzzy is Charlie.
Charlie, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hi, how are you guys doing tonight?
Good, how are you?
Okay, just got a quick question. I'm in the process of learning Java. I have a Perl programming background, but I'm having a hard time with mastering Swing and the Java GUI. And so I'm working my way through the Dummies books and the Sam's book, and I just acquired the O'Reilly Monkey book for that. But I'm wondering if you guys have any helpful resources that I can look at to help master the Java, Swing Java.
What are you having a hard time with? Are you just doing like really heavy GUI work, or are you having a hard time with MVC coming over from Perl, or what's giving you a hard time?
I think that's really the is understanding how their actual listener and event listeners interact with GUI portions of it.
I don't use, we do a little bit of a Java Swing development, but it's been a long time. We're using stuff like EXTJS and some other stuff because everything's kind of web-based instead of, desktop-based. What I would do is, if you're not familiar with MVC, is go do some reading, like see if there's an O'Reilly book, or just, go out maybe to Wikipedia and read up on MVC, because what's going to happen is you're going to get the syntax, the language down, but you don't necessarily understand the design patterns, and you don't necessarily understand the correct way to go about, extending design elements and, getting them on the page and then being able to, operate on them, from within the model that they're using. So MVC is just model view control, and it takes the data and separates it from the actual business logic and separates all that from the actual, the GUI part. So it's like you kind of have to write, three different pieces and have them all work together to get one thing to happen. And that does take a little bit of time to get your head around. So I'm thinking, go read up on MVC first and look at maybe even, maybe go back, and I don't think anyone's doing any MVC in Perl, but if you can find some basic MVC MVC diagrams and, you know, some ways that other people are doing it, that's the first step. Because once you can recognize, these are the three different parts, then you get to see what they're doing, because otherwise you don't know why they're doing different pieces of the code and why, you know, certain handlers are doing certain things until you see the bigger picture. So go read up on that, I would say, and then go from there. But there's a lot of free stuff out there on MVC. If you just put MVC tutorial into Google, I'm sure there's stuff out there. And there's probably even stuff that talks about it in relation to, like, AWT and in relation to Swing.
Yeah, I've searched. There's not a whole lot out there, but I'll go back and look at MVC. All right, thank you very much, guys.
Good luck. Thanks for your call.
All right, bye.
All right. 713-526-5738. Nobody called in to fill in the gaps on our open line system, open situation. But if you want to be on the air with us tonight, it looks like we'll probably have time for another couple of calls. We do have one in the queue we're going to take here in a second. But if you want to be on the air with us, call us up at 713-526-KPFT. Groovehouse?
Yes.
Who's up?
Up next, we're going to take Paul.
Paul, you're on the air with Technology Bytes.
Oh, yes. I have a couple of questions regarding about proxies and wireless connections.
Proxies and wireless connections. Those don't sound to me like they go together, but do they?
Yeah, they can. Yeah, if you've got a proxy server and you're trying to hit it from a wireless connection, but usually it's you tackle in two separate ways. One, you tackle connecting to the Wi-Fi, and then the proxy server is usually something a little bit different. But what's the question?
What's the situation?
Pretty much, I do have a wireless connection, and I'm trying to figure out how to use a proxy at the same time.
Do you have your own proxy server set up already?
Not yet.
What are you trying to do? What's your ultimate goal?
Pretty much to see how I call it attain. See if it's a secure line.
Well, are you wanting to browse the web anonymously? Is that your goal?
Yes.
Okay. Do you have a proxy server that you're wanting to use?
Pretty much yes.
You do. Where is this proxy server located?
Pretty much. Don't know where it's located, but I do know the IP and the router.
Okay, so what you have to do in order to use a proxy like that, you have to configure your browser in the proxy settings. You have to input that IP address into your proxy settings in your browser.
Okay, then. I have one more question.
All right.
It's regarding about the browser. I have two browsers, pretty much Internet Explorer and Firefox. And mostly, I'm only using mostly Firefox.
True.
Pretty much, do I have to set the Firefox proxy on that one?
If you want to use a browser to surf anonymously using a proxy server, you have to configure that browser with the IP address of the proxy server you want to use. So if it's Firefox, you need to go into the settings of Firefox and configure your proxy. If it's Internet Explorer, you need to go into the settings of Internet Explorer and configure the proxy. If you're using both, then you should do it for both.
You may want to check out, just to make this a lot easier, go check out Tor, which is the Onion router. So if you go to torproject.org, they actually make a Tor browser that scrambles a lot of your stuff and gives you pretty much anonymity as they can give you. And there are also there are plugins, I think, for the other browsers, too. But go grab the Tor browser. It's simple. It works right out of the box. And, you can actually trust, I think, a lot of the Tor routers, whereas if you've just got an IP of a proxy server and you don't know anything else about it, I don't know. That's kind of sketchy.
Okay, then. Pretty much that answered my questions. Regarding about the wireless, it actually will actually put me in anonymity.
The wireless won't put. I mean, I don't understand how you're drawing a correlation between the wireless and the proxy. Wireless is just going to be how you connect to the internet. Are you talking about connecting to your wireless at your house?
Yes.
You just connect to your wireless at your house.
Okay.
To browse anonymously, then you use. All you're doing is you're filtering your requests to the internet through a proxy server.
What that means is, like, if you were going to, like, try and ditch some bad guys, or you didn't want people to know where you were, like, instead of, like, going to the scene of the crime from your house and going straight back to your house, what you're doing is you're going to, like, some random house and coming in from a different part of town and then leaving that same way, so people that are trying to watch your traffic, it's really hard for them to tell who you are and where you're coming from.
Okay,
so that's really all it is. You're bouncing your traffic through different servers around the web, where if anyone tried to trace it down, there wouldn't be a direct line straight back to you.
Okay, then. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your call. Try to be careful out there.
Thank you again.
All right.
Surf safe.
Yeah, practice safe hex.
There you go.
All right, Groove House?
Yes.
Who's up next?
All right, up next, we're going to take Paul.
Paul, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm having a lot of problems in Windows 7 Home Premium 64-bit with blue screens. There's a lot of different blue screen errors that I get. And in Action Center, I used to be able to see what the error was after the system came back up. And it's not tracking it anymore. So I'm trying to find out how to get it back into Action Center so that I can hunt down the reason for the blue screen.
Don't know. If you're having a, whenever I have a computer that's going through having issues with blue screens, I don't troubleshoot it using the Action Center. I've never done that. First of all, the computer, is it a name brand? Is it a Dell, an HP, or something like that, or is it a home built?
It's a Lenovo.
Lenovo. All right. I assume that, how old is the Lenovo?
About a year and a half.
About a year and a half, and, you're set, and it didn't have these blue screen issues early on?
It started having them shortly after I started adding applications to it. And I've already gone through and taken everything out of startup. And it clears up for a couple of weeks and then comes back.
But if you started to install applications and that caused the computer to start to blue screen, it could be a sign that you have a hardware issue. Unfortunately, if you waited a year and a half to address this with a manufacturer, then you're out of luck on the warranty.
Well, I took it into Fry's, and they ran a scan on it and said that there wasn't a hardware problem.
Okay. Well,
that doesn't mean there's not.
That, yeah, it's hard sometimes to detect them. It sounds to me like you've got possibly a memory issue. Now, the blue screens, you can write down those. The computer, when you get a blue screen, does it just freeze and you can read the blue screen at your leisure, or does it reboot automatically?
It does both. I don't know what makes the difference, but sometimes it does one, sometimes it does the other.
Well, a lot of times you can take the part of the error code from the blue screen if it stops and you can see it, and you can Google search that to find out what that's a symptom of, whether it's hardware related, because almost always these blue screens tend to be hardware issues. It's either because the hardware is malfunctioning or it's because the driver is not working properly. So you have to kind of trace it down to what piece of hardware is being affected by this. A lot of times it's video cards, sometimes it's the wireless card sometimes, but then sometimes it actually is a hardware problem like memory, you know, but the code will tell you, and you can use that, plug that into Google to do some research on it.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. Good luck. Thanks for your call. All right. Bye. All right. Well, that's all the calls we have. 9 minutes left in the show. What are we going to do? Twiddle our thumbs?
You can kill 9 minutes of air, right? Stretch.
I'm going to do the best I can.
We can take a call if they call in.
We'll see what happens.
We will take a call if they call in. 713-526-5738.
Yeah, I'm starting to fade here. I'm getting kind of tired.
It's late. It's way past our bedtime. We should really...
the older we get, the more late, the earlier becomes past our bedtime.
You just wait, Groove. You just wait.
You kid.
You're young and vital.
Till 10.
Hey, man, I'm up past my bedtime.
Were you hitting your coffee earlier? I didn't notice you with a...
I had my coffee. Okay. I'm just tired. But it's been a stressful couple of weeks, just, you know, dealing with, you know, stuff. All right, Groove House is screening a call, so we'll have somebody to fill up the last few minutes of our show. And don't chat his ear off if you actually want to be on the air. And
he's just making sure he's not a serial killer, that's all.
What are we worried about serial killers for? They kill young people. How many movies do you see where the serial killer goes out and victimizes?
The young person is talking to
you. Oh, the serial port's dead anyway. It's like,
I'm
on
not
USB.
Worried. You know, it's like at my age, I'm not worried about being the victim of a serial killer.
Maybe you should.
Unless it's an elderly serial killer, and all I have to do is outwalk him. outrun him in my walker. All right, Groovehouse.
Yep.
We have a call, huh?
Last call of the show.
Last call of the show. Who is it? What do they want?
Maurice.
Maurice, you're on the air.
How you doing, sir? Thanks for taking my call that late. Two questions. First, I was a victim of two computers crashing on me. One of them I cannot get to start at all, and the other one I had a blue screen like the previous caller said. And now I'm contemplating the idea of using one of those softwares, a scan registry. Is it any good? Does it protect really your hardware and your software? Does it organize what you cannot do by yourself by going and cleaning up and stuff like that, or it's no good?
My philosophy on registry scanners is that they don't do what they tout, what they say they're going to do, and they can sometimes cause problems. Because what a registry scanner is designed to do is go and look for anomalies. And so whenever you install a program on your computer, you install an application, it makes changes to the registry so the program will run. And then when you uninstall the program, it's supposed to go back and clean up all that stuff and remove its, the changes that it made to the registry. But I don't know a software programmer out there who cares about the uninstall routine. So the when you uninstall a program or the program is removed from your computer, it leaves kind of a mess. It doesn't care about getting its deposit back. So, the registry cleaner is designed, supposedly going to go through that and look at that and try to clean that up. And the only one that I found that I like at all is CCleaner, C-C-L-E-A-N-E-R. But even then, if you're having a lot of registry issues and crashing and performance issues, sometimes it's just worth it to just back up your data, reload the system, and it'll be, the system may be as good as new.
That brings me to the second question that I told you about. Now, I have backed up my computer, my second computer. Unfortunately, I didn't back up the first computer. Now, every time I try to open a program, it says that it cannot be read or it cannot be opened because I have a newer version of Windows, probably. I don't know why, but that's what I get. Is there a way to make it like a user-friendly kind of backup data, or what can I do?
What do you mean you try to open something up in your backup, or?
Like I have a, yeah, like a hard drive, external hard drive that I save the data to.
Uh-huh.
And supposedly is saving all those pictures, all those letters, all those, you know, projects and research projects that I've done. But when I try to open them, I see them there. But when I click on them, it says it cannot be read.
That's because you need, are you opening it with the backup program?
I assume.
Don't assume. Do you know? In other words, you have to launch the backup program and navigate through the backup program to get it to see it.
That's what I'm doing. I'm going back to the hard drive, to the external hard drive.
I don't think you can launch those items. I think you actually have to restore them before you can.
You have to launch. If you're trying to restore from a backup you made, what backup software did you use?
I used, I don't know what, it's an HP Simple Save, one of those hard drives.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. We got to let you go. But you need to probably look at the software that came with that, launch that software, and have it go and read the backup files to be able to restore them.
Can you tell me off air how can I do that?
I won't have time this evening. You can email me. You can use the contact form on the website, and I'll try to help you that way.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you for your call. All right. Well, that's it. It's time to go. I'm ready to leave myself and go get some rest.
It's nappy time.
Not really. I've got to actually go meet a friend of mine for a little chat, but got some legal business to take care of. But then I'm going to go home and go to sleep. So anyway, we appreciate you tuning in tonight. Thank you for being a part of Technology Bites. Hopefully we'll have Flicted and Peter back next week. I don't know for sure on the Flicted, but I'm hoping. Seems like he's been gone long enough, if you ask me. So, anyway, stick around. More great programming coming up after this here locally on a Wednesday night on KPFT. We got Vegan World Radio. Check your local listings if you're listening outside of the Houston area. This is Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Dwight.
And he's
Groovehouse.
girl who rocks? Are you a girl who rocks? If you answered yes to any of these, you belong at Girls Rock Camp Houston. Girls Rock Camp Houston is back in its third year and is currently seeking motivated volunteers. Girls Rock Camp Houston is an annual summer camp empowering young women ages 8 through 18 through the gift of music. Volunteer opportunities include vocal and instrument instructors, as well as camp setup crew. Volunteers are needed during camp week, July 29th through August 5th, 2012. Check us out at girlsrockhouston.org, or for more information, email us at volunteer@girlsrockhouston.org. Once again, that's volunteer@girlsrockhouston.org.
You interested in volunteering at KPFT? If so, come to our volunteer training session Friday, June 29th, 12 noon, or Saturday, June 30th at 3 p.m. located at KPFT Pacifica Radio, 419 Lovett Boulevard. We have opportunities in the news department and graphic design. In the production department, you can learn radio engineering or production assistance, fundraising, groundskeeping, building maintenance, or meet people and help us at any of the many events that KPFT does in the community. Add KPFT to your resume. Show the world you give of yourself and your time. Go to kpft.org and fill out a volunteer request form or call Anthony.